welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about many different things on the political scene here today, but before we can move on, we've reported quite a bit on private prisons on this show, and much of our coverage has analyzed what seemed to be the twilight of that industry due to the movement against mass incarceration. Well, seems like we weren't exactly right on that score. The biggest news on this front this year was the previous announcement several months back by the Department of Justice that they would phase out their private prison contracts by eliminating or substantially reducing the size of the contracts. And they're already backing out of this promise. Corrections Corporations of America, the largest private prison operator on earth, which has now changed its name to Core Civic, announced last week that the Bureau of Prisons had renewed its contract to run McRae Correctional Facility in Georgia with only about an 8% reduction in inmate beds. The ACLU has pointed out that CCA's usual total neglect for prison conditions was 100% present at McRae. According to their reporting, quote, one prisoner there was denied his epilepsy medication until a seizure forced him into the hospital. And even now, the McRae guards only give him half the amount of medication prescribed by the hospital doctor, end quote. They also note that, quote, many prisoners placed in SHU, that's solitary confinement, have been subjected to discipline simply for exercising their right to pursue legal activities as provided for in federal regulations and BOP policy, end quote. The BOP has also renewed their contract with almost no changes with the second largest private prison company in the world, too, GEO Group, to run the D. Ray James Correctional Facility, also in Georgia. It shouldn't be terribly surprising then that private prison stocks are blowing up. CCA's stock surged massively following Donald Trump's election as well, which of course is not at all surprising. Why? Well, because private prison companies dominate immigration detention, with 62% of private prison beds in the immigration detention system currently being run by private corporations. The Obama administration had already moved on this with a number of announcements of increased work with private prison companies in immigration detention. Cibola County Correctional Center in Millen, New Mexico, will now be run by CCA. Immigration officials also renewed their contract with CCA to run South Texas Residential Center in Dilley, Texas. And surprise, surprise, this facility actually was recently blocked from operating certain services because of mistreatment of children. Blocked by the courts, that is. Under Trump, the ACLU estimates there could be a need for as many as 9 new federal prisons and 100,000 new detention beds in 2017 alone if Trump follows through with his stated deportation plans. May not surprise you as well to know that recently GEO Group hired 2 former aides to Jeff Sessions, potentially the next attorney general, to argue for more outsourcing of federal prison contracts. So while Obama got big headlines for taking on private prisons, he quietly has walked that back, and President Trump looks like he may be the harbinger for a golden era of private prison contracts. And with former Senator Jeff Sessions' aides now going to lobby the Trump administration on behalf of private prisons, that raises a pretty interesting question. What's going on with that promise to hashtag drain the swamp that Trump made? The question begs for an answer to an even greater degree now that The Intercept has revealed that literally the same day Trump announced the settlement in the Trump University case, where he was running a fake university, by the way, that Newt Gingrich was giving advice to lobbyists about how to expand the fake college industry. Gingrich, who's a top-level Trump advisor, spoke at the Career Education Colleges and Universities Organization, which used to be called the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities, and like most corporate-controlled entities facing big scandals over fraud or other types of abuses, when the fire gets hot, you change your name. So the name change tells us something. Gingrich's main advice was that the universities start to use their student bodies more as citizen lobbyists. In particular, he noted it was important to have them reach out to the Black and Latino caucuses in Congress so that they can see the quote-unquote human side of the issue. So ultimately, let me translate Gingrich's whole message. He was saying that the only way to keep these for-profit college schemes going is to, and they're widely proven now, to saddle students with Everest-sized mountains of debt and useless job certificates, is to get a percentage of the poor people of color you're bilking for these so-called educations, then get them to lobby their congresspeople and give those same congresspeople money at the same time, so that way they'll make for-profit education look like a civil rights issue. Smart lobbying, I guess. And it may even sound a little laughable, but honestly, this is the exact script the charter school movement used to start to dismantle public education all around the country. And all of this, of course, raises some questions about whether or not Trump really wanted there to be any sort of real changes with lobbyists from the beginning, or if it was a bait and switch. And when you look at his actual proposal for what he's going to do about lobbyists, well, looks like a bait and switch. First and foremost, Trump's ban acts like the past doesn't exist. So you lobbied for 30 years? Well, hey, just deregister right now and you can immediately work in the Trump administration. Further, as many have noted, the Department of Justice literally has sat on thousands of cases of conflicts with lobbying rules without prosecuting nary a one. And even further, the number of lobbyists themselves has actually been declining as people have just stopped registering as lobbyists and represent themselves as something other than lobbyists while continuing to lobby. And beyond one sentence that claims he will deal with some of these loopholes, there's no meat on those bones in Trump's proposal. And so to add insult to injury for those who thought he would drain the swamp, Trump has also added tons of lobbyists and billionaires to his transition team and a few to his cabinet to shape his future government. I'll tell you what, if it keeps going like this, the Trump team may want to switch hashtags and borrow one from the Florida Gators. Hashtag welcome to the swamp. Massachusetts is wrestling with a massive legal problem. A couple weeks back, the state's highest court heard arguments around what to do about the cases involving a disgraced crime lab chemist, Annie Dukin. Dukin served 3 years in jail after revelations surfaced in 2012 that over 40,000 cases were tainted when she deliberately lied and tampered with drug evidence. The scale of the fraud by Dukin, who, for the record, has always maintained with some justice now that it wasn't just her, but the culture of clearing cases throughout the prosecutor's office and police departments that led to this. But anyway, that the scale of the fraud is so massive that to throw out every case has raised some concerns by some on the side of the prosecutors and law enforcement. But the process they set up, this is the prosecutors and law enforcement after this came out, has been going on now for 4 years. Now, in those 4 years, they haven't even gotten to half of the 40,000 cases. And so as the ACLU is now arguing, there's about 24,000 cases that are outstanding. Some of these people are not even in prison, but are being denied jobs and housing because of things they probably never did due to discrimination for this. And so the ACLU and public defenders are arguing all 24,000 cases should be dismissed. Public defenders also noting that they couldn't even produce the amount of lawyers they would need to actually defend these people. So it's a big issue. The case is ongoing. It's unclear what will happen. But again, it's a reminder of how deep injustice runs in the criminal justice system, really right to the heart. You may remember, for instance, one study we also have mentioned on this show about a different issue, but that's about how a study of 340 exonerations noted that 13% of adults and 42% of juveniles falsely confessed. The Innocence Project, which works to obtain the release of falsely convicted individuals, noted that 1 in 4 people who were falsely convicted and later released via DNA evidence had given false confessions. So whether it's false confessions, tainted evidence, racial bias, you put all that together and the justice system looks like more of a misnomer than an accurate description. And we want to continue to update our listeners on the retrial of Ray Tensing, the University of Cincinnati police officer who senselessly murdered Samuel DuBose during what should have been a routine traffic stop. After Tensing was able to go free due to a mistrial, prosecutors have refiled the charges. Now the judge in the case has recused herself, saying there should be a total blank slate, and prosecutors have now moved to have the case sent to another jurisdiction. The prosecutor's case for a change of venue rests around fears among the jurors in the initial trial that because of how charged and the tensions around this case in Cincinnati, they wouldn't really want to be identified as jurors in the case. The saga is ongoing, but the fact still remains that justice is elusive in cases of police murder, even with clear misconduct like what we saw in this case. Either way, we'll make sure we keep you up to date as to whether or not this one case may provide a glimmer of accountability for murderers who hide behind their badges. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined for this discussion by Angela Bibbins, ground coordinator for the Water Protector Legal Collective. And Angela is Santee Dakota by heritage and has been at the camp since August. Angela, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course, of course. And so a class action lawsuit filed this Monday against police excessive force. And before I get to the lawsuit itself, But one of the things that I think is clear is who was this filed against? Because, you know, one of the things, there's such a thicket of police agencies and private guards involved. I think it can be a little hard to get our heads around, like, kind of the who's who and what's what on the side of the type of repression we're seeing.
Sure. So the main respondent in this case is the Morton County Sheriff's Department and any assisting law enforcement agencies that they have called in, and particularly might have been present the night of November 20th.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. Now that we got that together. So just tell us a little bit maybe now about what the lawsuit is alleging regarding what took place there on November 20th, where many of us, I think, witnessed via video and photos what appeared to be quite brutal assault there by the police.
Sure. And the way that I characterize it is that it was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life, that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors in 22-degree temperatures after dark was only meant to inflict pain and suffering on, you know, almost 300 people that were injured that evening, many of them, most of them exposed to the freezing, wet conditions that were created by the Morton County Sheriff's Department and were hypothermic, some had to be evacuated, some had to be taken by ambulance to the level one trauma centers in Bismarck and also IHS and Fort Yates Indian Health Services.
Mm. Wow. Well, and one of the questions I have is, I think the context of this lawsuit is that there are at least reports that potentially the camp could be cleared on December 5th. But with this type of spotlight that's being put out here in terms of the type of actions these folks are using happening, I mean, could this lawsuit play any role in perhaps preventing that eviction from taking place?
I think there would have to be a separate injunction to prevent any kind of military force that could be used by the state of North Dakota to evacuate the camp. It remains a concern, although I've gotten conflicting messages. Today I was on a conference call with some folks from the county government, Child Protection Services and Emergency Response Services, that said, no, that's not the governor's intention to clear the camp by any kind of forceful means, that it's really just to put everybody on notice that there are health and safety risks that are involved with this encampment in winter conditions. And I'm still confused about what the county knows that the governor knows. They just don't seem to be very coordinated. But Morton County seems to be really clear about one thing, and that is that they want the encampment to go away. And one of the things that they've said today is that they're kind of backpedaling on is that they're going to start stopping people who look like they have supplies that are heading to the camp, lumber, food, propane, all of those kinds of things. And it's, again, pretty specious that they would stop people just for, you know, carting around goods and services on public highways when there is no other basis for, you know, no articulable, reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot in order to perpetrate that stop.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems like it's the ultimate irony, too, is that they keep saying, well, there's all these risks, all these safety and security risks, but it seems like a lot of them they're creating. I mean, they're attacking people when they're trying to clear bridges. They're saying they're going to stop people with potentially critically supplies and this kind of cold weather. I mean, it almost seems like what they're alleging is happening, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because they're creating it.
And certainly that's the position of the camp. We had a press conference last night where many of the tribal leaders, and I was, you know, privileged to be involved, made comment in response to the governor's proclamation. It's actually called, like, you know, an executive order, which implies that there wasn't any feed, you know, any kind of discussion. This is just came from the governor's office that this is what they want to have happen with the camp. And as far as I know, from my ancestral heritage, winter in North Dakota has never been by itself a state of emergency.
Well, perhaps they're going to try to set a new precedent here with that. I mean, and certainly they will. I mean, you know, one of the things that I think is maybe also sort of important to touch here is that, you know, I think a lot of what they're presenting is that, well, it's been clashes on both sides. So these people are complaining about police brutality, but, you know, they've been doing other things to us. I've seen no real evidence of that. I mean, it seems like that also in and of itself is a fanciful narrative about what's happening there.
Sure. And just like the Morton County Sheriff's Department got on NBC on November 21st, the morning after the hell that was unleashed on water protectors at the North Bridge, they stated that they did unleash the water cannons because they were trying to put out fires, when clearly all the video footage that has circulated about that event has no evidence of fires. And just, although there are some flares that you see coming from the police barricade side to the side of the water protectors, which could have caused fires after the cannons were unleashed.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly a very relevant point, and certainly we will see how much of this can come out in the course of the lawsuit, and we'll continue to be covering this just day in and day out. Thank you, Angela, who again is the ground coordinator for the Water Protector Legal Collective, and definitely check them out and figure out if there's ways that you can help. We're going to take a break. We're going to be back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about many things around Standing Rock, what's going to happen there, people who are going there, and how that relates to building a broader progressive movement in this country that can seriously challenge both power and for power. And we are joined in this conversation by Aurelia Williams, who's a student at Georgia State University in Atlanta, also an activist there, and Anoa Chango, who's an attorney, the host of The Way with Anoa, and also in Atlanta. So this is a peach tree show, if you will. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Of course, of course. So, Aurelia, I'll start with you. Big news here on the horizon is the Standing Rock struggle, the potential that folks are going to be displaced there from the encampments, the water protectors. You are getting ready to go to Standing Rock. Why?
Yes, I am. Well, because now that they are blocking supplies, they're blocking media, it is more imperative than ever that we get as many bodies in between this pipeline and this water than ever. It is absolutely so important that anybody who is able get out there right now, because the eviction notice is December 5th. And as we're starting to see shaping up earlier this week, they're beginning to really crack down, and it's going to be, you know, absolute mayhem out there. And I'm personally going because as a Black and Native American person, I feel incredibly connected to the struggle that is going on at Standing Rock right now. And I feel really, really necessary to help these water protectors in any way that I can.
No, I think that that's, well, first of all, thank you for going. I think it's a fantastic and a great solidarity call. And, you know, one of the reasons I asked that in Noah is related to this next question I want to ask is, you know, seeing all the different types of forces that have been pulled into Standing Rock and are showing solidarity with it around the country, around the world. I mean, to me, it just sort of seemed like, you know, despite all the conversation we're having about what the quote unquote movement should look like in the age of Trump, we're talking about it so much, but to some degree, we're seeing it at Standing Rock, and maybe this is something that we should be looking at what's going on there and how we start to recreate that. Because, I mean, it's been remarkable to me to see how really somewhat people from really just about every corner of every progressive struggle and even beyond that have jumped in solidarity.
Absolutely. And sis, if there is an Atlanta contingent, if y'all got a donation link or something like that, it's Giving Tuesday. Shoot it to me, please, because I don't got a lot, but I will contribute what I can, because she's absolutely right. People being able to get out there, it's so crucial. I wish I'd had my leave from Roots Camp and was able to go out there myself. But definitely, I think that, you know, there has been so much focus on, oh, my God, what do we now do because of Trump? But like you just said, we've already been seeing what people are doing in the face of, you know, abject oppression and tyranny. Right. I mean, we just celebrated, quote unquote, Thanksgiving last week. And on the eve of a holiday of thankfulness, we had excessive corporate entities, you know, and the state government in North Dakota and other, you know, actors bearing down in some of the most violent and just aggressive manner we've seen, you know, in state action in recent years. And our president is pardoning turkeys and you know, I mean, we it's going to come from the people. And seeing the push, seeing, you know, activists from all different walks of life, seeing folks go out there, the veterans for Standing Rock are set to head out there. Even though the eviction is set for the 5th, the veterans are still going ahead with their trip. They will be on site December 4th. I'm trying to think of who else just announced that they were going out there. Well, so absolutely, this is an extension of what we've already seen with so much activism and movement building over the last several years. And I really think that the tone is being set now that people are not going to back down. And we really do see we have to do it ourselves. There's all this stuff about, I know you already talked about the fake news thing, but just to touch on that for a second, if it wasn't for podcasts like yours and mine, if it wasn't for, you know, these alternative news outlets, a lot of people wouldn't even know what is happening on the ground. If it wasn't for indigenous news sources, people wouldn't even know. Why? Because the mainstream media and many of the so-called good guy Democrats are on the take and are not even paying attention until they have no choice but to pay attention. So we definitely need people on the ground. Shout out to Desiree Kane, who's been there at the camp since, I believe, like July or so. I mean, it's winter. People are hunkering down. And no matter how much the governor claims he's trying to do things for their safety and the Army Corps engineer claims they're doing things for their safety, this is warfare. And we cannot be moved. We have to stand with folks. If you can't go, donate. But definitely show support however you can.
No, absolutely. I think that's a great point. I'm actually glad you brought up the fake news thing because, I mean, it raises it raises many questions. But, I mean, it raises another question, I think, Aurelia, which is, you know, the importance of telling our own stories here. Because I've been thinking a lot about this in the context of Standing Rock where, you know, in the media, there's this whole sort of hue and cry. Well, it's not just in the media. I mean, it's everywhere. But this whole conversation amongst sort of like progressives or whatever about like – identity politics. And to some degree, the conversation is centering around like, how should the Democratic Party be orienting itself? But like right now, in most circles I'm in that are like progressive people, and that's how the media is covering it, people aren't like worried about who in the DNC is going to be their leader. They're looking to the people who are at Standing Rock and going to Standing Rock and organizing solidarity as their real leaders. But that's not reflected on MSNBC. They'll just do 1,000 stories about whether or not, you know, Bernie Sanders and Keith Ellison and, you know, Chuck Schumer are going to get along or whatever. It just seems like without our own stories and our own narrative, we're really in trouble.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think that our own stories and our own narratives are important because that's how we've been doing things for forever. You know, like you want people in the same struggles as you who look like you to be telling stories that affect you. You know, that's why we have things like BET. That's why we have things like All Black magazines. Like, that's why we have media by us, for us, you know, because like people are running around right now like chickens with their heads cut off because they're like, okay, what do we do under Trump? Like, who's going to be this leader? Who's going to be that leader? But the fact of the matter is, under a black president on the eve of Thanksgiving, we have water protectors being sprayed with water cannons laced with chemicals. We have people getting their limbs blown off with shock grenades. We have people getting hit by rubber bullets under a black president. So it's not so much like, what are we going to do, you know, in the future? Who are going to be the leaders in the future? I think the media and these fake news outlets have so much power that they choose to focus not what's going on right now, but the future, because they know that they could actually have an impact on what's going on right now. Like, if MSNBC and CNN and Fox News were to actually run the truth, then people in this country might wake up and actually go do something about it. It is the job of the mainstream media to feed the people in part what they want to hear, which is why I think it's so important that we have independent news outlets that are getting, you know, the truth out there. Because if people aren't getting news from, like, sources that care about their issues, then they'll never be able to find out, like, the actual stories. You know, like, if I'm constantly getting news from people on Fox who are, like, old white people, they're not going to be talking about the things that affect me as, you know, a young Black woman. So I think independent news is incredibly important because it's usually non-biased and it's usually as close to the truth as you can get. It's like its own, you know, beautiful form of resistance.
And, you know, to swing back around to this really quickly, because Aurelia, your comments just made me think about this, and I think, Anoa, this is very relevant, and I wonder what your take is on this. I mean, it seems like the Washington Post with that fake news article is really pulling an okey-doke there, because if you look at the list of people they put on there, Truthout, that's why Aurelia's comments sparked this and be like, Truthout, Truthout, I mean, like a bunch of just like very reputable, but Black Agenda Report, but clearly critical of capitalism to some degree, certainly critical of imperialism to some degree. So, you know, people might call them quote-unquote left-wing news outlets. I consider them just to be critical news outlets. But, I mean, it seems the Washington Post especially, and for people who don't know listening to this show, is really a center-right newspaper, and it always is trying to find little ways to undermine people who are more to the left of them. And this, that's to some degree what that seemed like to me. Not so much about the Russian media or all these fake news sites or whatever, but more a great attempt, this random group, proper not, that no one's ever heard of, that no one can link to, and that all of a sudden all these very reputable sites that will talk about Standing Rock, that will talk about the movement for Black Lives, are labeled fake news.
Absolutely, absolutely. The site with the anonymous whomever with their very unprofessional social media presence as well was created in what, August, just a few months ago. So the site that claims you shouldn't listen to all these people without all this reputation is itself that same type of, you know, site that it says you're not supposed to listen to. And this is the sole source that Washington Post is running this narrative on. But we've seen this, right? We've seen these slanderous, you know, stories that attempt to completely derail narratives. We saw this during the primary against Bernie Sanders. We've seen this on so many other different issues. I mean, Washington Post has its own history with the whole weapons of mass destruction and Iraq war stuff too, right? So you know, it's not a credible source in of itself. And I absolutely agree the fact that this was when that fake news story first came out, and the pressure was like, well, it's Facebook's fault because of the fake news and da-da-da-da, and they were talking about how we're going to crack down on fake news. I'm like, wait, what are you talking about? Most people know that if it's .com.co, it's fake. Most people know what fake news is. There's something else they're talking about there, and even though there is a legitimate issue, I think, on a small scale, but at the same time, I was waiting to see if it would expand, and that's exactly what happened. Just like you said, it expanded to legitimate sites that offer a critical analysis of issues outside of the mainstream narrative. And that has continued to grow, and it's absolutely necessary. And instead of, you know, everyone's talking about we need to figure out a way to combat Trump, you would think that embracing independent media would be what would be done, versus Democrats are still trying to control, mainstream Democrats are still trying to control a very particular narrative in a very particular place. They have no interest in change. They just want the power back. And that happens by trying to convince people that these group of people over here are liars and they're bad because they're Russian or they're unknowing. They're so stupid. You know, Eugene, you and I are just so stupid. We don't know that we're Russian pawns, basically. and it's just, it's like the most insulting thing ever, because I have so many people I know who are so smart and they're like, yeah, because this Russian news thing. I'm like, look, let me tell you something. There is no Russian news. One, there's no Russian hack. There's no Russian news. Like, you guys, just all of it is just like, it's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq all over again. Until we're giving proof, I'm not buying into it at all. And even if they come up with quote-unquote proof, I'm still going to side-eye it.
Yeah, well, I mean, and certainly technically, and actually the German, like the head German spy actually raised this. He said that basically, even though he then said it was definitely Russia, he was like, but you know, you can't really tell who does these things. But nevertheless, it's talking about the post-truth era. Perhaps we should start to look at our own intelligence agencies. But Aurelia, let me also ask you this, just switching gears. We're just going to touch on a lot of stuff today. You know, one of the things I've also been reflecting on is in the wake of Fidel Castro's death, and thinking about Assata Shakur, and then that made me think about the controversy with the movement for Black Lives over Palestine, if that, you know, in sort of the quote unquote era of Trump, if people are talking about building movements of resistance. And at a time when we're talking about Standing Rock, the Sioux, a sovereign nation, being treated as a colonized entity. I mean, they are to some degree. But that being said, how important is it that the discourse, that the conversation, that the language that these movements are using reject this sort of like patriotic, I'm an American, this and that sort of thing, and really look to transcend both borders, languages, whatever, around the issues of importance to them as a movement? I think it's as Nelson Mandela said about the foreign policy of the ANC, our attitude towards any force is their attitude towards our liberation struggle.
That's good. I think that's just like looking at it in terms of nations and, you know, different types of struggle. I think it's just a way that they divide us. To me, Palestinian liberation is Black liberation. Like, free Palestine, hell yeah. Like, I'm going to go down, you know, fighting for free Palestine, you know, forever. It's the same reason why, like, I'm going to Standing Rock. Like, all of these struggles are connected a lot of the times in ways, you know, we don't understand. Like, Black liberation is liberation for everybody, you know, like women's liberation is liberation for everybody. So I think when we look at these struggles from the lens of like nations and things like that, it's really just a way to divide us. And it really just takes away from the work, particularly when we're looking at the movement for Black lives, right? We have to look at the entire African diaspora, right? Because like a lot of our struggles are incredibly interconnected. So, you know, I think when like organizers get bogged down and like, oh, well, I'm for Black liberation, but, you know, I rock with Israel and I don't really believe in like free Palestine, blah, blah, blah. I think that it just takes like a deeper level of understanding because the problems are connected and a lot more nuanced than we understand. Like whenever I meet an organizer who's like down for Black lives, but like isn't down for Palestine, I just usually tell them to like, you know, read some stuff and like you'll figure out why these two struggles are very closely connected. So I think, you know, if you're for one, you're kind of for them all. Like if you're a freedom fighter, then you're a freedom fighter. You know, if you're for liberation, then you're for liberation, full stop. Like if somebody somewhere needs to get free, I support them.
Well, that's a That is a good quote right there. Somewhere I'll have to try to use that. But I think, Anoa, that it's a key point. It's a clear point that we have to sort of make and continue to point out there as we move forward. And I think a lot of the discussions that we're having on, you know, leadership and this, that, and the third could be much more deeply and better informed if we had a more international perspective and looked at something just beyond what happens in America, which is fine. I think many people do. But I think the government, in many ways, and the media have sort of a concerted effort to, you know, whatever, try to prevent that. But that being said, that's going to have to do it for this segment here on today's show. I want to give a big thanks to Aurelia Williams, who's at Georgia State University in Atlanta and is a political and social activist in that city and around the country on her way to Standing Rock, wishing her great success. And Anoa Changa, attorney and host of The Way with Anoa, which is a great podcast. Please check that out as well. We are going to be back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about one of our most talked about topics in terms of prisons and incarceration, but giving it a wrinkle. We're talking about what's going on with those issues in the United Kingdom today. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Nikki Jameson, who's the writer of the Prisoner Fight Back column in the Fight Racism, Fight Imperialism newspaper based in the United Kingdom. Nikki, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Nice to talk to you.
Of course. And so, new report just released noted that the highest number of suicides ever reported, at least in England and in Wales, was this year. It's a big year. I think many people in the United States perhaps a little surprised to see that. I think there's sort of a myth over here that prisons in the UK are a little bit nicer or more humane or whatever you may say. So this report seems to put lie to that. So your thoughts?
Well, I think comparing to the US, you start from a really low bar. So, it's not comparable to anywhere what you have to deal with. But Britain has the highest rate of incarceration in Western Europe and jails for the longest and treats people kind of the worst within this little capitalist framework that we're in here. So the suicide level rising is not really a surprise on top of everything else. There's been increased deaths, increased self-harm, increased drug overdoses, increased attempted hangings, all of this kind of thing in the recent period. But, you know, that said, the prisons here have never been a bed of roses, whatever anyone may think about them.
Well, and talk a little bit about the conditions inside of prisons. I mean, I know in America, I know all about this. I mean, overcrowding is a big issue, lack of healthcare services. I mean, all these different things that people have pointed out to. And so seeing these statistics about suicides, I mean, are we looking at a similar situation over in Britain?
Yeah, you're looking at a really similar situation. I mean, if you forget for a slight minute the actual incarceration figures, although shocking for us and not shocking for you, all of the same things appertain. A high rate of overcrowding, a terrible healthcare system within prison, a huge amount of, although prisoners are used for their labor in jail, a huge amount of underemployment in the sense that people are there looked up with. I mean, I'm not saying that they have to be put to work, but, mm-hmm. With nothing to do, no education programs. There's this whole myth about rehabilitation and offending behavior and preparation for release, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, in reality, people are simply warehoused in prison until it's time for them to get out. And mm-hmm. then when they get out, they usually have nowhere to go and nothing to do. I mean, although we're talking a much smaller level than you are, I think I have to keep on saying this, nonetheless, for us it's shocking. And actually, if you look at the kind of class and race breakdown of jails and prisons in Britain, you get something even more shocking. I mean, if I told somebody in the States that 1 in 10 prisoners in this country is 1 in 10 male prisoners is black, Afro-American or African Caribbean. That sounds low to you, but actually comparative to the British population, that's actually a higher disproportionality than in the US. So, that's the beginning of, who's in jail. There's a huge number of people who haven't been working, were sleeping on the streets, go to jail, come back, go back to sleeping on the streets. It's just a sort of revolving door, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, too, because I think one of obviously the questions that is talked about the most in America is this issue of race and class disparities in terms of who's in prison and how much the laws themselves are set up to essentially, have social control over similar populations. And so hearing a big disparity like that, like you just laid out in terms of race, I mean, are we again looking at something that at least, if not on scale, at least conceptually is very similar?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. And on top, although I don't have the specific statistics in front of it, there's a very large, I mean, all of the statistics, apart from anything else, all of the statistics that exist for imprisonment in this country, how many people are in jail, how many people are locked up, only mean criminal prisons. They don't count immigration detention centres for a start. I mean, it's a whole separate system which has burgeoned massively. I mean, it's funny, there are real parallels between what's gone on. So in the same way, the biggest increase in U.S. prison populations happened under Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
In Britain, it happened under the 1997 to 2003 Labour government,
wow.
During which time the number of people incarcerated for criminal offences doubled. They invented 3,000 new criminal offences, some of which it's hard to actually divide the racial profile in there, but a lot of them It's not so much the drugs thing which has been the issue, but an awful lot of the actual criminal offences pertain to immigration itself. So whereby, for example, working on false documents was not in it, was a civil offence previously, it became a criminal offence. So all sorts of things that are simply related to coming into this country from outside and trying to survive became a criminal offence. So that clearly skews not just the people who are detained under immigration law, but the people who are kind of manufactured, as it were, into criminals.
Mm.
Not because you or I would think they've committed a crime. And in fact, lots of sort of general citizens wouldn't really see them as having committed a crime particularly, but the fact of the things that they've had to do to live here has turned them into criminals.
Well,
and I think that's had a big effect.
Yeah, well, I think that's huge. I have to say, it's one of those things where I every time I think there's nothing worse about Tony Blair, something new gets added. So we'll have to put that one in the charge sheet as we continue to move forward. And, you know, one of the things that, speaking of what you just said about immigration, too, is, I mean, I think we'd have to expect that to get worse over there now under Theresa May's government. I mean, it seems like in the context of Brexit and everything like that, they're going to make criminalizing immigrants even bigger part of the overall sort of central focus of the government.
Yeah, sure. And that's already happened when she was, before she was prime minister, she was home secretary.
Mm.
And this had already started under her home secretaryship. And even before the referendum, there was a big drive to start rounding up people who were from European countries who were here, who weren't in jail, but who were either homeless or were had an outstanding criminal charge in their own country, which could be a parking ticket.
Mm, wow.
Yeah, but the fact that they had it and they had been seen to have not declared it when they came to this country was then considered to have potentially invalidated their right to be here. So there's been huge sort of sweeps of this kind of stuff. I mean, these people tend to not see jail. They get, you know, arrested, they go to a police station, and they're told that they're leaving the country.
Mm.
But a number of them are contesting it and so on. So there's, you know, all of this stuff is going on, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Well, I mean, it's certainly interesting. And I'm also curious, I mean, obviously, as you know, there's a big conversation in this country around, you know, criminal justice reform and making some changes. And, you know, it's interesting to see the news from the UK, because I remember seeing somewhat recently, it might have even been of August of this year, Michael Gove, who I believe was the justice minister at that time, saying something that seemed like perhaps he was moving in a direction of reform, that they need to put fewer people in prisons. But then something told me, how is that coming from the Conservative government? There must be something else going on here. So, I mean, is there something of a quote-unquote bipartisan consensus to maybe make some changes here, or in the prison system in Britain, or is this more or less just smoke and mirrors on the part of the government?
Well, listen, you know as well as I do, if anyone in any of our major political parties, ruling parties, mentions the word reform, you have to be suspicious by what they mean by it. Gove was education minister before he was Home Secretary or Justice Secretary briefly, and his whole kind of remit is this academisation, which essentially is just introducing more private sector motive into whatever it is. So his whole thing, or it's a funny way of working, so what he wanted to do, and is still due to happen, was to take a number of prisons which are, quote, failing, put a governor in charge. They weren't being handed over to the private sector. They're continuing to be run in the state sector, but they would have a governor in charge of them who would have this degree of autonomy about what they did. And so the governor, and they've done it to six prisons, and they're going to do it to another 10. And so the governor can then decide how to spend the budget and how to do certain things. Obviously, actually, this all comes with an increased degree of centralized control and oversight. But that's another story. But theoretically, the governor could decide that he was going to have a really good program where everybody, you know, if provided they met certain criteria, could have days where they went home at weekends to see their family or stuff. theoretically. But also, the same governor is there to do more deals about what happens to who does security contracts within the prison, who he's paying to put more CCTV up, and who he's selling prisoners' labour to. And I know you and I have had this conversation before, with slight scepticism about the prison industrial complex, but I'm kind of coming a bit more round to it in some ways, because the current white paper, which Gove started and has now gone by his successor, is full of references to prison governors building up relationships with local businesses so they can profit from prisoners' labour. And it says in it, I'll quote from it, it says, "The governor will be able to design the prison day to meet commercial opportunities rather than trying to shoehorn the work into a centrally prescribed timetable and to recruit the right staff to train prisoners and oversee the work. They will be able to incentivize prisoners as they advance through workshops, as they learn new skills and take on responsibilities," blah, 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 blah. Wow. But I mean, the main point of it is that they'll use, whether it works or not, but they're going to use... They'll be able to use prisoners as a resource whose work they can sell to outside people, and that's, you know, that's the reform. So it's not that reformy, really.
No, not at all. Also, I mean, I don't even know this is a random aside, but Michael Gove also wanted to bring back hanging as a form of capital punishment. So this is the type of people we're dealing with.
Something that, you know, one of the things that you can kind of think we're blessed that for the moment we don't have over here,
Well, certainly we can hope that stays that way. And on a related note, in terms of security contracts and people in prisons and people complaining, I saw the Prison Officers Association, POA, that's for people in America, the Prison Guards Union, basically, over on that side of things. And they were...
Who've always been pro-hanging, I have to say.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Well, they've been sort of protesting, saying they want more money for prisons and better conditions or whatever. Similar story all the time in the United States, where these prison guard unions will come out, sort of cry crocodile tears. But also, especially in the state of California, you know, the biggest advocates for some of the mass incarceration policies. So it's all, you know, wrapped up. But, you know, for those of us over here, is the POA playing a similar type of role as we see prison guard unions play over here, as really sort of reinforcing the views of the state, but doing it in a way that can occasionally appear like maybe they want something different?
Yeah, identical. I mean, it isn't even quite the views of the state. They have their own very specific agenda, right? So actually, ironically, at the moment, they have, in the recent period, there have been cuts to their numbers, and it's almost the first time you could, I'm not particularly sympathetic, but I could say there's a grain of truth in what they've been saying. They've been crying wolf for so long. Forever and a day, the Prison Officers Association's kind of battle cry is, we are understaffed and these prisoners are dangerous. Actually, outside of the north of Ireland, which is kind of different because of the war there and how political prisoners were locked up and there were a lot of attacks on prison guards, outside of them, actually it's 100 years since a prison officer was killed by a prisoner inside a jail in this country, which is a really... So it's actually not that dangerous for them. I mean, relatively... compared to the police, for example, but it's all a kind of, you know, it's so dangerous, it's so terrible in there, we're the only people who can deal with it. All of this might have some kind of resonance if what they were then striking for and demanding were increased funding to give prisoners education, rehabilitation, all kinds of things that would stop them turning violence on themselves or on other people, because, you know, there is an increasing degree of violence, it's true, but actually all they're demanding when they came out the other day is they're demanding more staff, which in the long term is one of the things that the government's likely to grant them, but in the short term they're just demanding that the prisoners are locked up for even more hours of the day. That's their demand.
Wow. Well, that, I mean, of all the things you think they could say, although I guess, you know, perhaps maybe they don't want to organize themselves out of jobs or something like that. But nevertheless, on a similar note, on the opposite side of things, for those, and as I mentioned earlier, you're the writer of the Prisoners Fight Back column and Fight Racism, Fight Imperialism. What kind of work is going on both inside and outside prisons to start to get some positive movement here?
Well, actually, I have to say at the moment, there's not an awful, you know, it's It's quite difficult at the moment. As I'm sure you're aware, I mean, you cannot impose from outside organisation on prisoners. Mm-hmm. That's the recent strikes that have happened in the US have only happened because people inside did them. It doesn't matter how many support groups you've got outside saying how willing and supportive they are. Mm-hmm. And there's relatively little organisation at the moment. I mean, clearly there are periodic demonstrations and riots and protests, of course, that's always been the case. There's not a lot going on. That's not to say there's nothing. Every now and then there are kind of groups who will stage, kind of a sit out saying, we're not going back to ourselves until this demand is met or that demand is met. And, advocates outside try to support that as much as possible. But there's relatively little going on at the moment. I mean, on the one hand, I'm saying the guards are crying wolf and banging their own drum as they usually do. On the other hand, it is true, as people have been highlighting, that the increase in certain types of drugs and certain types of violence within the prison population makes it even harder for those who are inside, who are trying to kind of do some kind of conscious organizing to get anywhere with it, because, you have quite a lot of upset and damaged people who are being exploited by other people, both those in uniform and some of them not. So, it's quite a different organizing environment. This is what I'm talking about here is the sort of general low security local prisons. Mm-hmm. The high security prisons tend to have always had a slight more politicization. I mean, they're where all the Irish prisoners were locked up. They're the ones that now hold the greatest number of Muslim prisoners. And there's a little bit more discipline, if you like, between people. So there, for example, they had a very brief but quite reasonable work strike. Well, no, it wasn't a work strike. It was just a sort of thing where they sat out of their cells and said, we're not doing this until the governor comes to see us to discuss the reductions in our regime. So we have things like that going on periodically. But as with everything, I mean, with the recent prison strikes that you've had, I know one of the difficulties is just even for people who are on it all the time, is just keeping up inside and outside with what's actually going on.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now. That was Nikki Jameson, who writes the Prisoners Fight Back column for Fight Racism, Fight Imperialism newspaper. Please check that out. That's going to do it for today's show here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.